And welcome back to Coast. I'm George Norrie. Tonight, Dr. Richard Sauter joins us. Experienced firsthand contact at a very early age with a variety of paranormal phenomena that have left him a little bit puzzled and thoroughly persuaded that there's much more to Earth and to human perception and consciousness than the mainstream American culture believes. Some of Richard's favorite research and reading interests are underwater bases and tunnels, the electronic mind control, freedom technology, human prehistory, remote antiquity, and kundalini energy with alternative thought patterns. He's back on Coast to Coast AM. Hey, Richard, how are you?
You know, I'm fine, George. How about yourself?
Good, good, indeed. You know, I am so fascinated with your work with underground bases, and so many other people are as well. How did you get involved in these? I mean, did you stumble into a tunnel or an underground base, or did you get some information? How did this all start?
Yeah, you know, I think it actually started when I was 6 years old, when I won a spelling bee at my little country two-room schoolhouse, and the teacher gave me as a prize a book about cave explorers, about spelunking, and it really fired my interest in what was happening underground. So I think I was sort of primed when I moved out to the Midwest many years later as an adult, to the Southwest to do graduate studies. And I heard people talking about alleged underground bases and tunnels where purportedly little gray aliens were working in great secrecy with clandestine elements of the American military. And I didn't know what to think about that. I thought the stories were interesting, but I didn't know if something like that could be true or not. So I just kind of mentally filed it and set it to the side. Later, I had a little time in my academic schedule, and I did some preliminary research, and I discovered, in fact, there are a lot of underground bases and installations run by a variety of different government agencies, both civilian and military, as well as some of the Fortune 500 companies. So I wrote that up in a little article for UFO magazine in L.A., and it appeared in early November of 1992. Well, at that point, I figured I had been there and done that. I had established that, indeed, underground bases did exist, but I didn't know what to say about aliens, so I didn't say anything. And so I figured, okay, that's it. I've exhausted the topic. Well, not quite. Over the holidays of that same year, the week between Christmas and New Year's, the last week of 1992, I was awakened out of a deep sleep one night in the middle of the night by a voice in my ear that said very clearly, just as clearly as I'm speaking to you right now, the underground bases are real. Well, that got my attention right away. And the voice went on to say that not only are they real, but there's an awful lot happening underground, that there are major projects and programs going on, that there are government agencies involved, and a lot of technology. And I got the impression that the scope and the scale of what was happening was very large.
Yeah.
And after 2 or 3 minutes of that, the voice stopped as abruptly as it had begun. And I never had any doubt that I was hearing the voice of a real man. It was a male voice, the voice of an adult male speaking normally accented late 20th century American English. Now, I never thought that I was hearing an angel or an extraterrestrial or a demon or Jesus or God or anything else. I always assumed from the first split second that I was hearing the voice of a real flesh and blood man who was speaking to me using some kind of exotic technology, which I understood, even as the experience was transpiring, to have probably been some type of electronic transmitter that targeted the auditory cortex of my brain and or the inner ear. And in fact, subsequently in my research, I discovered there was such a patent given. And it's actually patent number 4,858,612, awarded in August of 1989, which details a microwave device for pulsing intelligible sound right into the human ear. So I assume something like that broadcasts this message into my inner ear or auditory cortex. And that's how I got started, George. The next day, when I woke up, I decided, you know, well, if this is as real as I was told last night in the middle of the night, there ought to be a paper trail, and I have discovered that paper trail. It exists, and I set it out in my books.
Great. Well, we're going to follow some of this. Now, these underground bases, Richard, are they all over the planet or just primarily in North America? Where are they?
Well, you know, I think they are all over the planet. I deal in my work mostly with North America, and in fact, mostly with the lower 48 states, just because I live in the lower 48 states, and so it's easier for me to research, you know, in the area where I live, in the region where I live. But in fact, my research has identified other underground installations in other countries, China, Russia, England, Israel, Saudi Arabia, many different places, Australia. So it's not just the United States that has constructed these facilities. They exist in many other countries as well. But having said that, there certainly are a great many of them here. And they're, I think, in every state. There are a variety of agencies that have made them.
And how deep are they, Richard?
Well, you know, that's an excellent question. And when I first got started, it's the same one I had. And naturally, it's something everyone wants to know. When I first got started in my research, before I knew much about this, I figured, well, you can just look in a government telephone directory and call up, you know, agencies and ask them about it. Well, I had heard something about FEMA, so I found a government telephone directory and a government documents repository or data collection. And I was going through this directory, and I found FEMA, and I thought, well, here's a list of FEMA telephone numbers. I'll just start calling them and see what I can find out. So there was an 800 number there. I called the number, and a very pleasant woman answered the phone, and we began to chat, and I asked her, say, I hear that FEMA has some underground facilities. Is this true? And she said, yes, it is. And I said, well, what can you tell me about it? And she said, well, I'm talking to you from underground right now.
And you believed her, right? I guess you had to.
Well, it was true. It was true. She told me the facility, and I asked her, well, how far underground are you? And as I recall, she thought maybe she was 30 feet underground, two or three stories down. I know where the facility is that she was working in, and I believe that would probably be accurate. Now, some of the FEMA facilities go a great deal deeper than that. So that's the first part of the answer to your question. They can be in the upper levels comparatively shallow, in some cases only 20 or 30 feet down, but they can extend much deeper than that. And I first began to get clued into that when I went to see a guy whom I had heard give a public talk on a different topic entirely, as I recall. But during the course of his talk, he made some comments that made me suspect he knew something about underground facilities. So I made an appointment to go see him at his office a week or two later, and went in, and he graciously gave me some of his some time out of his schedule. So I sat down and just point blank started asking him about underground bases, and I asked him about one location in particular, and he said, well, you know, actually, there is an underground facility there. And of course, then I asked him, as you have just asked me, well, how deep is it? And he looked at me and said, without blanking, it's 1 mile.
1 mile deep?
Oh, yeah. So that got my attention. And so I immediately felt like he was pulling my leg, because I assumed that he was just playing me for a fool to see how credulous I was. and whether he could put one over on me. But then I perceived that he was very serious and that he certainly had nothing to gain for pulling the wool over my eyes, because no one knew that I was there but him and me.
All right, Richard, so, stay with us. We're going to take this quick break. We're going to come right back and talk more about these underground bases and also get into what are they trying to do with them and why don't a lot of people talk about them. We'll be back. And welcome back to Coast to Coast. I'm George Norrie, Dr. Richard Sauter with us as we talk about underground bases and tunnels. Richard, why aren't we getting a lot of people who have been involved in these tunnels? Because I'm sure there have been thousands who have been involved in construction. Why aren't they saying anything?
Well, there's a lot of fear, George. This whole program is surrounded by secrecy. It takes place at a very high level of classification in many instances. People sign very rigorous security oaths. These projects are compartmentalized, and so they just don't talk. But as you observe, indeed there are thousands of people involved. One of my sources told me what I already knew after having told me of some of the work that he's done underground. And in answer to my questions, he said, well, the reality is there are many underground bases and there are thousands of people working in them. Well, I already knew that, but it was glad to have it ratified by an insider, if you will. So, you know, we talk about in popular discourse in this country about how America is a free country, but you know, a lot of people are walking around carrying tremendous fear, under tremendous pressure, not to say what they know, afraid to say what they know. And that's the reality of America. That's the deep split in our consciousness. And we pay a heavy price for that on many levels. I want to say, George, that, with regard to the depth of these facilities, I don't know how deep the deepest ones are, but I know from the open literature and documentation that I've seen, it's no problem to go easily 1 mile underground. And I've seen, indications that even 2 miles or 3 miles is within the state of the art. And maybe they can even go deeper than that. I don't know how far material science has advanced in the black world, because I'm not in the black world, but I'm prepared to think that material science in the black world is a lot further along than it is in the technology that we use in our everyday lives. And if that's the case, it could be that they can go many miles underground by this time. But certainly 1 mile, as it has been explained to me in very clear terms, is child's play. It's the state of the art to go 1 mile down and make a major facility.
What are the possibilities of what might be going on down there?
Okay. I have often mused about this and asked people about this. And what's come through to me over the years is that, of course, you have command, control, and communication facilities, the so-called CCC facilities. Now, there's some good examples of those. I suppose one of the best would be the FEMA base under Mount Weather in Northern Virginia. That's been there for many years, ever since the 1950s, I believe. It's quite large. It actually amounts to a town underground. Another example of that would be the Cheyenne Mountain facility in Colorado, which has now been partially decommissioned, and part of its function has been moved, I believe, to Peterson Air Force Base. And also in that category would be the underground facility that NATO built at Thunder Bay up in Ontario, Canada. And then there's another example of that for FEMA and the open literature, and that would be along Riggs Road between Olney and Laytonville, Maryland. This is in suburban Maryland, not too far north of Washington, D.C. And there they also have, FEMA has an underground command center I talked to one guy who'd been in there, and it goes down multiple levels. It's just crammed with electronics and communication gear, as you would imagine.
Sure.
And so you have those types of facilities. Another example of that would be the Site R, so-called Raven Rock, what is sometimes referred to as the alternate Pentagon Command Center. And that is on the border between Maryland and Pennsylvania, between Frederick, Maryland, and Gettysburg, Pennsylvania. And that's a major underground base as well. Now, that's one thing that's going on underground. There's gold storage underground. We've all heard about Fort Knox. Whether there's any gold still there, I don't know, George. But allegedly there was at one time gold stored underground there, and supposedly there still is. Also, at the World Trade Center, before the towers were collapsed in the 9/11 attacks, there was gold stored underground there in vaults. And my understanding is there is gold stored in underground vaults elsewhere in New York and other places around the world, such as London and so forth. Weapons are sometimes stored underground, including nuclear weapons, and or deployed in the case of nuclear missile silos, which are underground. Also, you find scientific research being carried out underground of various kinds. Now, of course, there have been rumors rampant for years of secret biological engineering, genetic engineering, cloning engineering, and technological experimentation taking place underground as a joint venture, more or less, of secretive elements of the United States military and extraterrestrial factions, most notably the Little Gray faction. That story's been out there for a long time, for decades now. I don't know the truth behind it. I don't dismiss it just because it sounds sensational and too melodramatic to be true. I'm presuming that there could be some truth to it. The more I find out, more anecdotal evidence keeps coming up that indicates something like that could be going on. So I don't dismiss those stories out of hand at all. Now, another function is there are a lot of, and when I say a lot, I mean scores, dozens of underground presidential hidey holes or bolt holes or bunkers, whatever you want to call them.
But that's smart business, though, I think.
Well,
don't
if you're
agree?
The president, yeah.
Yeah.
For sure.
Or there's got to be a place to go to keep government moving, God forbid, if there's an attack.
They're all over the country, and not just for the president, but for others. And they've been there for decades. There are also supercomputing facilities underground. Some of the best known, I guess, would be at Fort Meade in Maryland for the NSA. Others I've heard of in New Mexico underground. There are also so-called arcs or places of refuge that have been built at different places in the event of apocalyptic scenarios that we might imagine, whether natural or man-made, for the preservation, presumably, of a relic human population. And if you don't know about it, then you're not on the list. Who is on the list? Well, clearly it's those who determine that they're worthy. And who determines that they're worthy? Well, if you don't know, you're not worthy in their estimation.
That's true. That's true. So some of the power brokers are on that list.
The objection I have to this secrecy, George, is that there's no oversight of this. It's all done in the dark, with trillions of dollars being skimmed out of the economy, and there's massive, rampant criminality involved, lying out the wazoo, and it's not constitutional government. It's not consonant with the spirit of the Bill of Rights or of the Declaration of Independence, as far as that goes. What I'm saying is this whole project is fundamentally un-American. We're talking about a shadow government, a secret government, an unconstitutional government, an un-American government. So I would
skimmed money,
to a certain extent.
With skimmed money as well.
all trillions of dollars. You know, it's interesting. I think you've interviewed Catherine Austin Fitz a number of times.
Sure.
And she's a very bright lady and a very gracious lady. She's also an expert on this matter of the black budget. You know, her background is in high finance, and she held high positions on Wall Street and also had a high position in the government in the first Bush administration. Now, she has documented conclusively that trillions of dollars have been skimmed out of government agencies.
No question.
And that is, well, let's put it this way. In Texas, if you hold up a 7-Eleven and you get a couple of $100, you're liable to do 10 years on a prison farm doing hard labor. In this case, we're talking about trillions of dollars being stolen from all of us. And I don't know if one soul has gone to jail for that.
Jeez. Okay, now let's go through some of these declassified statements and what you might have uncovered in terms of records that you might be able to help provide us with some more information.
I can absolutely tell you that when I began, my first inclination when the voice spoke to me in the night was, there must be documentation, because at that time I was involved in a doctoral program in political science, and I know because of studying government bureaucracies and also corporate bureaucracies that if there's one thing they do, they produce paper, documents, memos, emails, invoices, you name it, paper of every description. The bigger the project, the more people involved, the more money involved, the more paper that will be generated. Plans, everything. So blueprints, you name it. So I thought, I'll go look through the literature. I'll go look through technical documents, patents. I'll go through archives. I'll read through government reports. I'll just comb through the literature with a fine-tooth comb. And I went through thousands and thousands and thousands of pages of all kinds of documents, reports, books, etc. And I made an interesting discovery along the way that my intuition was sure. Yes, indeed, these people do produce paper and a lot of it. And one of the things that I found was a surprising statement by Lloyd Dusha made in 1987 at an open conference at MIT up in Boston,
all right,
having to do with underground excavation, tunneling, and construction. Now, Lloyd Dusha was the deputy secretary at that time of the deputy director of the Army Corps of Engineers. And in his talk to this conference, he said point blank, you know, after World War II, political and economic factors changed, and the underground construction picture changed, and as a result, we had a renewed interest to, in his words, think underground. And we, the Corps of Engineers, became involved in the design and construction of some very complex and interesting military projects. And he went on to say that although the conference program indicates the topic of my talk to be underground facilities for defense, I have to deviate a little because several of the most interesting facilities that have been designed and constructed by the Corps are classified. And then he went on to say that there are other projects of similar scope, which I can't identify, but which included multiple chambers up to 50 feet wide and 100 feet high, using the same excavation procedures mentioned for the NORAD facility, which he also talked about in his conference talk. Now, the Army Corps of Engineers helped make the NORAD facility. And so what he's saying here in plain English is, hey, we've made secret underground bases, and they're pretty damned interesting, large, and complex. But, oh, by the way, I can't really tell you about them. Only, oops, I just did. So you won't find a franker statement on the public record in the open engineering literature than that the United States government, in this case the military, has been making secret underground basis. So there's the question right now, many answer to the question that many people have. How can you prove there's a secret underground basis?
Mm-hmm.
And that's the way. Now, I want to say, again, going to this question of how deep can they be, that I uncovered in one of the archives I looked at and a record that included a letter from Dr. Robert W. Vandola, who was, I believe at that time, the director of the U.S. Bureau of Mines. This is 1966. And he was writing to Dr. William McLean, who at that time was technical director for research and development at the China Lake Naval Weapons Station right in California. And that's still a major R&D facility for the Navy today. But he says, in response to a question that Dr. McLean had obviously posed to him, and talking with some of our mining experts here, I find a consensus that sinking a shaft to 11,000 feet, that's more than 2 miles straight down, George, and driving a shaft horizontally from this presents no severe problems, other than money, perhaps, if the rock is competent and not faulted. So right there, he's saying in that first sentence, the consensus in the mining engineering industry is that, yeah, we can sink a shaft 2 miles straight down and then drive a tunnel out from the bottom of that shaft. That'd be 2 miles underground. One of the most difficult problems, he continues, in deep mines is a sealing off of aquifers. It would seem that even if the rock were competent throughout the tunnel and drift, there might be rather difficult problems in breaking through to the bottom of the ocean and maintaining a seal against the high water pressure. There he gets down to it, because clearly what Dr. McLean was driving at was making a tunnel out under the seabed and bringing a shaft out onto the sea floor so you could bring personnel and equipment and materiel through an airlock to and from a manned base down on the seafloor. And I say that because that same year of 1966, also coming out of China Lake from a R&D study group or R&D project group that Dr. McLean had set up there, there was another memo that came out entitled The Rock Site Concept. And the abstract for that Rockside paper said quite clearly in just two sentences, large undersea installations with a shirt sleeve environment have existed under the continental shelf for many decades. And that's speaking there of commercial industrial mines under the ocean. The technology now exists using off-the-shelf petroleum, mining, submarine, and nuclear equipment to establish permanent manned installations within the seafloor that do not have any air, umbilical, or other connection with the land or water surface, yet maintain a normal one-atmosphere environment within, meaning a shirt-sleeve environment within. And the document goes on to say what it's talking about is tunneling actually hundreds of miles out to sea, under the seafloor, down in the rock in the seabed, and they're making large, permanently manned installations. And I have other documentation showing that these installations would actually be submarine bases. Submarines would come and dock inside,
And there's a connection, some kind of portal where they can go through it, I guess.
Yes. In fact, in some of the illustrations that I've seen that came out of this project back in the mid-1960s at China Lake, that there would be submarine locks, where actual huge ballistic missile-firing submarines could go in and out. And if you've ever seen these submarines and know about them, they're quite large vessels. They're hundreds of feet long. And, from the top of the conning tower all the way down to the keel, you may be talking about 100 feet in some cases, maybe more. So they're
We'll talk more when we come back, coast to coast, Dan. Richard, about, just on the average, how many people do you think are in each base, each underground base?
You know, George, I almost can't answer that question. The simple answer is I don't know. What I can tell you is that and at full occupancy, some of these bases certainly can hold a couple of thousand people, maybe even much more. That I can tell you from the open literature. The smaller facilities at any one time might just have a handful of personnel in them, but the larger ones, like Mount Weather or Site R or Cheyenne Mountain in its heyday, other ones like that of similar size and importance might have had hundreds at any time. So they can be quite large and sophisticated, really like small towns deep underground. So I hope that'll give you some idea. Now, as to the total number of personnel underground, I have actually posed that question to people that I have interviewed over the years, and no one can really say, and here's why. Because of the extreme compartmentalization in this country and in other countries right around the world, there's no way of knowing. Even if, say, you work for the Navy or the Air Force or the Army might not even know what the Navy is doing, and the Navy may not know completely what the Air Force is doing. And they all might have questions about what the Department of Energy is doing or the NSA. And vice versa. So great is the compartmentalization. They may not even fully be aware of all of the other underground facilities that various military agencies and government agencies have. What to speak of the corporate agencies and other organizations such as religious orders or fraternal organizations and that type of thing. So it's virtually an impossible question to answer. It varies from base to base, facility to facility.
Richard, if you had to paint a picture, what do they look like down there, these places?
Which, you mean the people or the installations?
The installations. And we'll get into the ETs a little later, but the installations themselves, what do you think they look like? I mean, they're kitchens, they have bunks, rooms.
Well, some of
like
them, earlier on, my understanding is a lot of them were comparatively rustic and Spartan, in that, yes, they had bunks and communal dining areas and that type of thing. But now the new generation of these facilities are really very sophisticated, with a fair number of creature comforts, so that it's not exactly like living topside because you're underground, but my understanding is it's like living in a multi-level building that you might experience in your everyday life, an apartment building or a office building or a corporate headquarters or something like that, with the exception that it's underground. Now, of course, some of these facilities have cavernous areas. I mean, some of the things that I've read and been told about some of the chambers and so-called rooms that exist in these subterranean facilities, they're vast. I mean, they can be hundreds of feet tall, hundreds of feet wide. I was one time in a conversation with one of my sources, and I asked him, how large can these underground spaces be, the open spaces in these underground bases? And he gave me an illustration of a mine here in the lower 48 that over the years was excavated such that when it was finished, if I understood him correctly, there was an interior space that was about 600 feet wide, 1,100 feet long, and about 1,100 feet or 1,000 feet tall.
That's pretty big.
Yeah. Now, the intention originally was not to just make a big space underground, but it so happened as the miners removed and excavated the ore, the mother lode, as it were, that eventually they were left with this huge, vast chamber as they removed that. And then the mine is no longer a working mine. But he illustrated his answer that way. In other words, simply by using conventional mining technology, you can make a huge underground space that you wouldn't know about viewing a mountain or the countryside from the surface. And so by implication, what he was telling me was, Richard, you can make huge, huge facilities underground, and you can't tell it just from walking by or driving by on the surface.
What is the Nazi connection, the Nazi angle to some of this, Richard?
Yeah, this always comes up. You know, you can see on the History Channel and other shows on television,
yeah,
and even in movies sometimes, this idea of the underground workings and bases that the Nazis built back in the 30s and 40s. And, you know, the Nazis had an organization, an agency called the Todt Organization, originally run by Fritz Todt, who was the German engineer who developed the Autobahn system of freeways, which exists to this day. It was very well done. And Fritz Todt was really a genius, a very gifted civil engineer. Well, during World War II, he was tapped to form an organization called the Todt Organization, which was more or less an analog in the Nazi system to what the Army Corps of Engineers would be in the American military system. And during World War II, the Todt Organization carried out extensive construction projects of all kinds for the Nazi military and for the SS. Now, that included making underground tunnels and underground factories and bases, some of them impressively large and sophisticated. There were the Regenwurmslager in what is now Poland, which was an extensive miles-long network of underground bases and tunnels with electric trains running through it, 150 feet underground, and also some very large underground industrial facilities for making aircraft and missiles and so forth. Now, Fritz Todt was killed during World War II in a plane crash, and a man named Xaver Dorsch took his place and was put in charge of the organization and held that position until war's end. Now, at the end of the war, I had documentation in my possession that shows that Xaver Dorsch was taken into custody by the American military occupation force and was extensively debriefed over about a two-year period. I have a couple of documents that he wrote for them, and essentially the Americans decided they were going to do what the Nazis did, and I also have a Project Paperclip memo seeking to bring Xaver Dorsch and some of the other Nazi engineers with expertise in that field to the United States to help create a so-called underground plant program for the United States military. Now, I don't know if Xaver Dorsch ever came to the United States, but he certainly was extensively debriefed by the U.S. Army, and they got his engineering knowledge in that fashion at the very least. But right after World War II, there was an explosion, if you will, of underground construction activity in this country by the military-industrial complex, and it has not ceased to this day. Now, I want to say also in that regard that there was that impetus from the Nazi military-industrial complex, but there was also, at the same time, another engineer in Germany named Hermann Kemper. And Hermann Kemper, during the Nazi period, had an invention that he was doing the research and design work on called the Rohrbahn. Now, the Rohrbahn was an underground high-speed magnetic levitation, so-called maglev tube shuttle train,
mm-hmm,
that was designed to travel through vacuum tubes, tunnels from which the air had been evacuated at very high speed. Hermann Kemper envisioned this network of high-speed maglev tunnel trains beneath Europe, traveling at speeds up to 1,200 miles per hour. Now, he developed these plans back in the 1930s and worked on this all up through World War II and continued his research after World War II And today, this research still goes on in Germany. In fact, the Germans are leading the world in maglev train technology, and just a few years ago installed a state-of-the-art maglev train in China. So it's Chinese and the Germans that are leading the pack now, and the Germans never stopped this research. They just continued with it down to the years. Now, of course, the question is, was this research brought over to the United States secretly? Because we have many rumors of just such a deep underground, high-speed maglev tube train system in this country, and that those stories have been around for the last 20 or 25 years anyway. So I wonder if when the Americans went into into Germany after the war, if they didn't just snatch up a lot of those plans and research and design blueprints and bring them back along with Wernher von Braun and a lot of engineers and other engineers.
Can you mention some of the states that you're sure have underground bases?
Oh, right off the top of my head,
yeah,
California for sure,
okay.
Texas for sure, Virginia, Maryland, Pennsylvania.
Indiana, because people talk about a hum near Kokomo.
Well, you know, I would say yes in Indiana. Let me tell you that the Midwest is dotted with huge underground caverns that were built by Phoenix and Sisson in past years and decades. And when I say they're huge, I mean they're gargantuan, George. And there are just scores and scores of these all across the Midwest, because the geology in much of the Midwest is very favorable for underground construction. And some of these are in Indiana as well. Now, let me say that Phoenix and Sisson, having built these, could turn them over to virtually anyone or sell them to virtually anyone for use for virtually anything.
Okay, you just mentioned geology. California, New Madrid Fault in the Midwest, down toward the south. What about earthquakes?
Doesn't matter much. And there are other states that have underground installations. New Mexico, for example, does. Colorado does. And Nevada, of course. So many states in this country have underground installations. Georgia has underground installations. On and on. So they're quite common. There are many of them. And these are just ones I know, states I know have installations. There are others, Massachusetts, that have them. I just know these off the top of my head. Now, there certainly are others that I don't know about, so they're quite common, George.
Richard, let's get into the ET angle for just a moment. Do you think, let's say, under Area 51, we can claim that's an underground base.
It is.
Are they storing craft down there?
I think they are.
And ETs themselves, extraterrestrials, are they there?
Yeah, I don't know if ETs themselves are there, but I've seen and heard enough that I do believe that there are some alien craft at so-called Area 51, and I believe also at other places. I think they would have them other places, they meaning the military-industrial espionage complex, meaning CIA, NSA, Army, Navy, Air Force, Marines, and then the major Pentagon contractors like Boeing, Northrop Grumman, Lockheed Martin, et cetera. These types of companies are very heavily into the black budget world, black
sure.
compartmentalized projects. So they would be involved at these facilities also. But yes, I think they do have them there and at White Sands and some other places as well.
What about alien underground bases that the aliens constructed?
I think they exist. Let me tell you, my answer is a little bit more nuanced than that, George.
All right.
And, of course, this is a burning question you see discussed on television programs, hinted at in movies, or actually shown in what have you in fictional form. But, yes, I think there are alien bases. There may even be a lot of them. And I believe in some cases they've been here for many, many thousands of years, going way, way back. Now, I also think that in some cases, because there's so much anecdotal evidence of this now, that there probably is a joint presence on the part of clandestine elements of the United States power structure. Let's put it that way, corporate, military, and civil, and that there is joint occupancy or joint tenancy with so-called extraterrestrial alien beings. Now, not all of these aliens are so-called little grays or reptilians. Some of them are human beings that look just like us. In other words, The Earth evidently is not the only planet in the galaxy with a resident human population. It appears that the human race, with minor differences from planet to planet, may be very widespread in this galaxy.
We may be, you know, we may be seated.
We may be seated, or we may be quarantined. I think it was about 25 years ago where I was in conversation with someone, and he mentioned to me the fact that the Earth was a prison planet. Now, that was the first time that anyone had ever broached that topic with me in any way, but instantly I recognized that that's probably the case. And in some sense, we are a prison planet. We are locked down. And in fact, our societies are very controlled, including right here in the United States. You know that the very well-known German philosopher and writer, Johann Wolfgang von Goethe, observed a couple hundred years ago that no man is more thoroughly enslaved than the one who falsely believes himself to be free.
True. So true.
And I just described hundreds of millions, if not billions, of people on this planet. In the United States, we assume that we're free, but we have pervasive surveillance by the NSA and the CIA and Homeland Security. We go to the airport, we take off our belt and our shoes, we empty our pockets, we have people question us, interrogate us, we're wanded, we're scanned, on and on. We're constantly having to show our identity papers, i.e. our driver's license or social security card for this, that, and the other thing. We're as controlled as a herd of cattle, George.
In your book, Underground Bases and Tunnels, What the Government is Trying to Hide, when you were researching it, Richard, was there anything that you stumbled across that startled you in terms of information?
Yeah, I would say yes, sir. The first thing that startled me was that I could find out so much information. Having just said that we live in a controlled society, it's a controlled society where bureaucracies generate a lot of paper that they assume no one will read. And in fact, most people don't ever read any of it. No one goes to these research, these document collections and so forth. I was startled, and this is the second thing that startled me. Number one, that the documents were there, but number two, that no one read them. I could go in the federal documents collections for hours and hours and hours, and sometimes not see another person for 3 or 4 hours on end because no one else would come into the stacks. And not only that, but I would pull a document off the shelf of 1950s vintage maybe, and I could see that in some cases no one in half a century had checked out that document from the library, that I was the first one. So that was the second thing that startled me.
And we'll get back to more, too. Plus, we'll talk about what you believe could be a secret space program, backing up what Richard C. Hoagland has always believed. Richard, before we get into what could be the secret space program, we're talking about some of the things that you uncovered in your book, and you were mentioning a couple points, and then the clock goddess. You want to continue?
Yeah. Okay. Well, you know, one of the other things that surprised me was that a lot of people actually have knowledge of what's going on underground. Because the operations are so extensive, it can't be totally hidden. And a lot of this stuff is, so to speak, hidden in plain sight. And if you know what you're looking at, you can discover a surprising amount of information. And I was pleasantly surprised to discover that a lot of people do have bits and pieces of this puzzle. And it's been very encouraging to me and helpful to me over the years to have people communicate what they know to me. So that was a pleasant surprise. And not surprising, given that so much money is involved. So many years have gone by. This has been going on for 50 or 60 or more years now. So many agencies are involved. There's technology involved. The sheer number of facilities. It really couldn't be otherwise. But it just goes to show that maybe we're our own best ally when push comes to shove, and that if we're going to, so to speak, reclaim not just North America or our society, but our planet, that it'll be a group effort with cooperation, one with the other, by exchanging information, by helping each other, and by having a spirit of mutual help, if you will.
The equipment that they use to build these bases, are we using it here now on the surface?
Well, underground, the actual machines that are used to build the tunnels, for example, the so-called tunnel boring machines, are in routine use in the mining industry and also in civil engineering for making tunnels of every variety and description. And they're also used on the clandestine or compartmentalized black projects. Now, I'm assuming there's also more exotic technology in use. That technology, no, I don't think would be openly used in the everyday world that George Noory or Richard Sauter might circulate in. But some of it certainly is, whether we're talking about structural steel or reinforced concrete, tunnel boring machines, front end loaders, or so forth. A lot of the equipment that is used topside would also be used underground to do similar things.
The secret space program. Of course, Richard Hoagland believes it's going on, and I'm beginning to think you believe it's going on as well.
Sure, I do.
And the technology that has been used to build these underground bases on this planet, is it possible that they have these bases on the moon, for example?
Well, you know, I think it is. And if you'd asked me that, you know, 30 years ago, I would have just not known what to say. I might have thought you were touched in the head. Now, even then, there may have been such facilities on the moon, in my opinion. Now, I think that the manned space program, in fact, could have begun in the early 1950s and been underway already 10 years and maybe more by the time NASA very publicly put up the first astronauts, Gus Grissom, John Glenn, Alan Shepard, so forth. That there are other technologies that evidently have been kicking around in the black world, such as anti-grav lifts and that type of thing, and that they have been held back from us. But yes, in my underground bases research, I have found numerous documents now with a provenance going all the way back to the 60s and extending right up to the 90s of a variety of agencies and think tanks talking about building bases on the moon and or building tunnel networks on the moon, and seriously. And I've run across enough of these reports now that I'm starting to think maybe the reason this is being discussed in the open literature is because it's really being done. And that the expectation is that sooner or later it'll break out into the public. And so in order to, you know, lay the engineering and scientific groundwork, so to speak, there are these conference papers and technical documents that are in the open literature. It occurs to me to ask that question because one of the men, or in fact the lead engineer on the R&D effort for the so-called nuclear tunneling machine, the subterranean tunneling machine,
yeah,
that was designed and developed, at least in concept, at Los Alamos during the late 60s to early 80s. This man's name is John Rowley, R-O-W-L-E-Y. And I'm satisfied the technology works, and I think he is too. The idea is that you take a SP100 fission reactor and you circulate liquid lithium that you heat to about 2,000 degrees through the cutting face of a tunneling machine, and it slices through solid rock like a hot knife through butter. Well, he did the R&D work for this at Los Alamos, but he's spoken very openly about using this machine to make a tunnel system on the moon. And in fact, he wrote a paper in 1985 entitled "In Situ Rock Melting Applied to Lunar Base Construction and for Exploration Drilling and Coring on the Moon." And he actually includes in the paper the diagrams of full-sized nuclear-powered tunneling machines. So, you know, this is the kind of thing I have found in open literature again and again. I'm starting to think that maybe it has been done. Of course, we don't have a machine that will carry a huge a space vehicle, at least openly,
right,
that will carry a huge tunnel-boring machine from Earth to the moon. So he evidently thinks it can be taken up there. But, George, I don't think so, not with chemical rockets.
No,
because
that's
these things weigh hundreds of tons.
Unless we've developed a form of levitation or anti-gravity device.
Well, and there's, you know, a fair amount of evidence that suggests that's the case. One of the things, and this is getting back to the surprises that you asked me to talk about, that I stumbled across in my research. When I started going through the technical literature, I started all the way back in the 40s. I went way back. And one of the things that I noticed was that there were references to anti-gravity research on the part of government agencies and research facilities and institutes. But it all dried up in a time period of say, the mid-50s to early 60s. It all went bye-bye. And the thought that occurred to me at the time was, no, it didn't go away. It just went black. It went into the classified world, into the top-secret realm, because I'm not an engineer, but I know enough about basic science and engineering that it seemed to me, just from the reading of the titles of the reports that I was seeing referenced, that some breakthrough was made, and I suspect enough of a breakthrough that the decision was made to take this black, like at Area 51 or White Sands or facilities like that, and develop it for the secret use of the military-industrial complex and to use it for their own purposes. And there's some evidence to suggest that that may have occurred. In fact, Nick Pope wrote his famous book, The Hunt for Zero Point, and I suspect you've interviewed Nick Cook, rather,
many times.
Or two.
Yeah. Why the cloak of secrecy, Richard? Why do they need to hide
free energy? Free energy, or at least energy that is a lot freer. When you have a whole species, 6.5 billion strong, who can unplug from Shell Oil, from Marathon Oil, you follow me, from Texaco.
I'm with you.
All of a sudden, the whole petrochemical complex takes a dive, and they're left high and dry. When you don't have to pay thousands of dollars for gasoline, for heating oil, for natural gas, for electricity, that's economically extremely freeing. It also would effectively put an end to the nuclear industry. So you're talking about huge multi-billion-dollar industries that would go bye-bye real fast. In other words, it would rework the entire industrial, economic, and political structure of this planet. And that's why.
Do you remember when there was construction, underground construction going on at Vice President Dick Cheney's house, and neighbors went nuts because they were so loud?
In fact, I talked to a lady that lives in the neighborhood there, and she wasn't happy about it. She said that, by the way, it was the United States Navy doing that, because the vice president's official residence is on the grounds of the U.S. Naval Observatory in Northwest Washington, D.C. Anyway, I talked to one of the ladies that is a local resident there, in that neighborhood. And she said it really annoyed people there because they were setting off, they were doing blasting. They were setting off explosives.
Yeah.
And it was rattling people's houses, shaking their foundations. I think some people may have had broken windows and smashed china even from that. So the locals weren't happy about it. And she said they put up, they being the Navy put up a huge tarp to block the construction activity from public view so that people driving by on the street or walking their dog down the sidewalk couldn't see what was going on. But it went on and on and on. It wasn't just a weekend remodeling project.
Did the mainstream media ever question him at any news?
Well, not directly, no. You know, the mainstream news media in this country are domesticated, man. They're just, let me use the word pathetic. Independent journalism or investigative journalism is virtually extinct in this country. We have a corporate media now who are just, it's a yes chorus, a chorus of yes men and yes women who don't ask probing questions with very rare exceptions. So the Washington Post did do a couple of stories about it, but they didn't probe very deeply. The Washington Post is it's a company rag, George, you know that.
Yeah. Well, the LA Times back about a year ago said that Cheney's house was off limits to Google Earth. That it was blurred. Google blurred the images of the house, so you really couldn't see what was going on from above.
Well, you know, it may be, but I don't. There again with Google, Google Earth blurred it, but certainly the Russian satellites were not blurring it. The Chinese satellites were not blurring it. Indian satellites weren't blurring it. Israeli satellites weren't blurring it. French satellites weren't blurring it. The only people in the dark, George, are the public in the United States, the intelligence agencies of other countries and the military agencies of other countries had a perfect view of everything. It's only we, the sheeple, who don't know, who are kept in the dark by design. So in reality, all this secrecy is designed to keep us ignorant because Chinese and Russians know exactly what's going on. It's us.
Thousands
we don't
of
know
people.
What's going on.
Thousands of people disappear in this country alone every year. Thousands of people. They're just gone.
Large numbers.
How do we know that they're not being yanked down in these tunnels for some reason?
Experimental. I don't know, George. You know, this issue comes up over and over and over. I've seen it raised by many people. It's what I can tell you is that I've looked into it. In fact, I discussed this question with Don Ecker of UFO Magazine. You may know Don and his wife, Vicky. And what, you know, Don, before he got into ufology years ago, was a policeman, actually, an investigator, a detective who worked for a department in the New York City metropolitan area. And this was something he noticed in the course of his police work, and he collected data from all of the police agencies in the New York metropolitan area, put them together, and came up with a very large number that deeply troubled him. So he went to the FBI, if I remember correctly, and the FBI was not responsive. I won't say they were non-responsive, but they were not very responsive. But he was left with the sobering conclusion that a lot of people are disappearing, and not all of the disappearances can be explained by murder or by parents running away with a child in a custody dispute, for example. Some disappearances certainly can be explained in those ways. In fact, sure, many of them can, but not all of them. And at the end of the day, he was left with a large number that deeply troubled him. Now, I've looked into some of this data as well, and I've reached the same conclusion. A lot of people run away. A lot of people go missing, and as time goes by, either their bodies are found or they resurface somewhere else or they resurface with a child in a custody dispute. But taking all of that into account, yes, a surprising number of people vanish in this country every year, never to be heard from again, and they're of both genders, of all ages, and of all ethnicities. So it's across the board. It's not just so-called milk carton kids. It's the problem is much larger than that. I suspect that some of them could be taken into underground facilities, because going back years now, I keep hearing stories about underground genetic engineering and cloning and so forth. And the issue of human guinea pigs arises. You may remember the Krista Tilton story from years ago, from the 1980s. And I don't know if you've ever interviewed Krista, have you?
I have not.
Okay. Well, I've talked to her two or three times now. And she and others saw troubling things underground, what appeared to be people being cloned and other things, which very much raises this kind of issue. And if that's the case, then we have a very dark reality taking place beneath our feet, a Nazi type of reality when you get right down to it. And I have to say, I directly asked this question to one of my well-informed sources several years ago, and the response I got from this man was that any people that were used for that type of research or experimentation underground would not be likely to be released alive, but would be dispatched of underground and disposed underground. That was his response.
Who started all of this, Richard? Whose idea was it to build these tunnels and these bases?
You know, I think it goes way back into the mists of prehistory, George.
Yeah, could be.
I think it goes back at least to the time of the Egyptians. And by the way, the Egyptians did a lot of underground work. There are a lot of tunnels under Giza and elsewhere in Egypt.
They've only scratched the surface, I bet.
Yes, there's quite a lot underground in Egypt. I've been there a couple of times, and I've seen enough just from what I observed as a more informed tourist than most by far. I can say the ancient Egyptians did a lot of underground tunneling, digging, construction, and excavation. And what you see when you go to Giza and other ancient archaeological sites in Egypt is a fraction of what's there, because there's a lot beneath the surface. But I think it goes back even further than that to Atlantean times. And yes, I accept that there was at least a previous round of high or sophisticated civilization on this planet, and perhaps several cycles going way back tens and hundreds of thousands of years. I accept that. And I think that's a conclusion a lot of other cutting-edge researchers are coming to. There have been some books written in that vein in recent years, and quite good ones, I might add, by authors whom I believe you have interviewed.
Fascinating work with Richard Sauter. We'll be back with him and your phone calls next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast. I'm George Norrie. We'll go to your phone calls in just a moment with Dr. Richard Sauter. Richard, where do you get the book, by the way, Underground Bases and Tunnels?
Well, there's a link up on your website if people look for that. Richard Dolan, whom you've interviewed many times, is hosting my books on his site. And there's a page devoted just to me, my articles and books. So if people want to click through there, that's where they'll find it.
Perfect. Let's go to some of the calls. We'll go to Grand Rapids, Michigan, to get things started on the wild card line. Hi, Jerry. Go ahead.
Hey, I was wondering what you could tell me about the Denver International Airport. I tried or sort of uncovered what seemed to be like some sort of a tunnel starting from the airport and heading out towards the Rocky Mountains, but I always seem to come up with a lot of dead ends. I was wondering if you knew anything about it.
All right, Jerry. And other than Richard, the strange artwork, what do you know about it?
Well, I don't know what he means that he's discovered a tunnel. Whether he's physically exploring a tunnel, and if so, how does he get down?
Let's ask him. Jerry, what did you mean by the tunnel?
I have not discovered a tunnel, just a lot of fishy things going on as far as, just a lot of different things that look strange. Like people have told me about buildings about a mile and a half or so far away, and there's a lot of I'm just a little bit nervous, but I guess what had people had been telling me about and what that there was about every mile and a half or so from the Denver International Airport down to the Rocky Mountains, there's what seemed like abandoned buildings, which aren't showing up on the Google Earth sites.
And they may be entrances. I was told, Richard, by a woman who worked at the airport several years ago that she saw a couple military guys walk down kind of a ramp that looked like it was a tunnel, and she said they never came back. And she was out there for several hours.
I couldn't even say. I don't know where the ramp is or anything. I don't know personally if there is a clandestine underground base at the Denver airport. I'm not saying there is or there isn't. I'm saying that I personally don't know. I do know that there are certainly things underground at the Denver airport. The baggage system is underground and runs through its own tunnels. There's a people mover or a train that runs out to the different concourses underground, and I've ridden that. It's very interesting. And, of course, there are utilities, tunnels for utilities underground at the Denver airport as well, also underground fuel storage and underground fuel lines. So, indeed, there are a lot of things underground. Whether there is an underground base of the sort that so many people are alleging is there, I don't know. I don't have any documentation on that. However, the murals are very interesting. There's no question that the Masons, or at least a Masonic group or lodge dedicated the Denver airport, and you can see that plaque there. I have seen it myself. And there's a lot of esoteric symbolism in the artwork at the Denver airport, which many people have commented on, and there's no doubt about it that there is some kind of, I don't know what you would call it, perhaps Illuminati involvement behind the artwork at the Denver airport. What it all portends, I don't know, but it seems that there's the expectation of some kind of apocalyptic period in our future, and I think you've interviewed Cliff High a time or two, George, and he certainly, with his webbot analysis, is detecting some very troubling times that lie ahead of us. So that's about what I can say about the Denver airport. Beyond that, I would also observe that it appears to me the Denver airport is a massive money laundering operation, that it's a way for the powers that be to wash billions of dollars, if you will.
Okay, let's go next to Carl, driving him around in Arizona. Hey, Carl.
Hey. George, I don't know if you remember, a few months ago I called in on an open line and told you about my dad that worked in NASA at Marshall Space Flight Center.
Yes, yes, that I remember that.
Underground.
Yeah.
I'll just recap for the guests. During Christmas and New Year's, there were very few people around. You know, most people took their vacations and stuff, and we would go with him, you know, maybe one day during that time. And he had taken us downstairs a couple of levels and shown us the civil defense bunkers that they had, you know, the food storages and what have you. And there was a staircase leading down another door, and I said, you know, what's down there? And he said, well, we can't go down there, you know. And so, well, you know, kind of had a dumb look on my face, and he said, let me tell you, what's below ground, I mean above ground here, is nothing compared to what's below ground. And, you know, the building that he worked in was tall enough to stand a rocket up in. So that was all that was said. I was a kid, you know, so I didn't really question him any further. But have you ever heard of anything at Marshall Space Flight Center?
Is that in Huntsville?
Yes.
Yes. Well, you know, Wernher von Braun was stationed there after he left Fort Bliss in White Sands area out in West Texas and southern New Mexico. He and his team moved over to Huntsville to work on at the Redstone Arsenal. And, yes, to answer your question, von Braun had the idea back in the 50s to put in an underground missile and rocket factory beneath Green Mountain, which is just on the outskirts of town. And they used the same model that the Tote organization in Germany did. In other words, it wasn't going to be the military that bought up the real estate. Rather, prominent and wealthy local people were prevailed upon to buy tracts of real estate on this mountain. And then the military was going to tunnel out and hollow out the mountain for this rocket production facility. I couldn't discover if they ever built anything inside the mountain from my documentary research, but I know that von Braun was very high on the idea and wanted to do it. The idea, I think, was to replicate the V-2 missile factory that the Nazis had underground, that the SS had built during World War II. And I think 10 years later, probably von Braun was thinking, hey, it worked in the Third Reich. Why don't we do the same thing here? And whether that missile facility was ever built or exists, I don't know. But yes, I don't have a hard time believing that something is underground there. Indeed, that whole region, that's the southern edge of the Appalachian Mountain region there in northern Alabama. But the whole Appalachian region running all the way from northern Alabama and northern Georgia right on up into New England is primo real estate for building underground bases, facilities, and installations of virtually any description for almost any use. And in fact, there are a fair number of them there that I know of from the open record, and I strongly presume there are many more secret ones that I do not know about.
Okay, next up we go to west of the Rockies. It's Anonymous. Hi there.
Bugging me for years. When I was young, I remember being underground at Moffett Field in California.
Okay.
I spent a long time trying to find any evidence that they even had underground, and this is in their big hangar. I ended up finding that they did, wind tunnel testing. Have you ever heard of that being a facility for anything underground?
No, I haven't, but it doesn't mean that there's nothing underground there. I don't know everything about everything. So, in fact, there's plenty of room and opportunity for other people to research this topic and write their own articles and books. I have certainly not exhausted the possibilities. So, you know, go get them, Tiger.
Why not? Let's go to Chattanooga, Tennessee. Hi, Janine. Good morning.
Discovered your program, and my father used to call your program all the time from Lake Worth.
Okay.
His name was Wayne. He used to talk about one world government and conspiracies and things that went on and the Illuminati and all these different wealthy people that were involved in bringing certain people to power and these underground tunnels and especially the Denver airport.
Mm-hmm.
And here it is like 20 years later, and I'm his daughter, and I'm thinking, oh, my gosh, you know, he used to order this newsletter called Power of Prophecy. The Denver airport is in the middle of nowhere, and there's two gargoyles there in the luggage area, which, of course, are satanic. And he used to order this letter, this newsletter called Power of Prophecy by Tex Mars.
Oh, sure.
And it gives all the people's names that are a part of this one world government takeover, and which ultimately will lead to the platform for the Antichrist. And I believe that there's so many secret evil things going on, and there's so many organizations involved in the destruction of America, and I think it's going to happen so fast.
Well, it's already happening too, Janine, and your father, by the way, was absolutely right. Many years ago, way before most people even knew what Illuminati was or conspiracies or one world government, he knew, and I think this program helped educate him, and it has so many other people. And, Richard, that's one of your main concerns about these underground bases, the fact that it's being done without our approval and our knowledge.
Oh, yeah. And also it's being done with our money and lots of it. I think it's it's the secrecy aspect, it's the theft aspect, it's the skulking around underground without telling anyone what's going on. It's trading on our goodwill. It's endangering us. Actually, we don't know what's happening underground. And in fact, people could be penned up by the millions down there. We wouldn't know. Remember how surprised some Germans, not all Germans to be sure, but remember how surprised some Germans were in the closing stages of World War to learn about the horrors in the prisoner of war camps and concentration camps. Many of them allegedly had no idea. And I've wondered often, George, if we are not like the so-called good Germans, we who sit watching the NFL for 8 hours every Sunday, etc., if we are not just as dumbed down and blind, and if terrible things are not happening in our land with our money, without our knowledge, and whether millions of people are suffering without our knowledge. I really wonder. If that's the case, we deserve to know. If that's the case, we must know. If that's the case, we must find out and rectify the situation. And in fact, just because you avert your gaze or look the other way, it doesn't mean that a bad situation cannot be occurring.
Good point. Okay, let's go to Sparky in Tennessee. Go ahead, Spark.
Well, thank you, sir. I'm retired military, and I also live here in Chattanooga. Thank you for letting me speak here real quick. I have just two little things I'd like to tell you. I was stationed in Europe, in Germany, during the late 80s, and I can guarantee you I know of no less than three mountains that were hollowed out. I know one place that was it was a lake, and this door used to open. This is during towards the end of the war. I'm a big scuba diver, and that's why when I was there, I met a lot of people, a lot of Germans who were scuba divers. They had to drain the water. There was only about a foot of water in this lake, and they would drain it, and it had metal floor. And they would land airplanes, and they would take off from this mountain, and they would seal it up and then refill the lake. And at the end of the war, the Allies didn't want to utilize that area, so they bombed it and destroyed it, and it just dropped. So that all that metal and everything is all still down there. And I've seen that. That's pretty neat to find out that this mountain was hollowed out and used for aircraft and who knows what.
Yeah, and I wonder if they went down as well, Sparky.
It did. You know? It went straight down.
Yeah.
That was just outside of Munich. But anyway, I know of another thing was during the late 70s, just before I joined the military, I was in the Civil Air Patrol. And it was a good organization, and we got together, and we decided one day that I was part of a team that found a C-141 that crashed up in the Smoky Mountains back in the late 70s. Don't know if you remember that or not. We decided that I was a young officer. We decided that we would get a hold of NOAA and ask if we could get, using our Civil Air Patrol ID, to see if we couldn't get heat images of the Smoky Mountains and other areas and see if we couldn't use the heat of the day to locate aircraft that were, you know, crashed in the Smokies. It was at that time, it was a great idea, we thought. And we received pages and pages of information and pages of maps. And one of the maps shows a 500-meter square area that's underground.
500 meters square. 1,500, yeah, so it's about, that's pretty good size.
It was huge.
Pretty good size.
Interestingly enough, we had this information for about 2 months before a car showed up and two guys came in and said that we had access to information we weren't supposed to have, and they took all that information away from us. But we already knew it, and we found where it was at and everything. I've even been there. I know exactly where it's at.
More and more verification, Richard, for what you do.
Yeah, in fact, the Appalachian region, as I indicated, it is a region with known facilities, and I keep hearing about other places, I think in the National Forest and all up and down through those mountains, there are numerous facilities, West Virginia, Western North Carolina, Tennessee, down into Alabama and Georgia, up into Vermont and New Hampshire, of course, in Pennsylvania and Virginia. There are just a lot of facilities in those mountains.
Let's go to, thank you, Sparky, by the way. We're going to have this break coming up, Richard. Then we'll come back with final phone calls with you. Where do you go from here? The research continues, Richard?
Well, yes. You know, I have a lengthy document that I'll be posting on the website in the next week or two, which is basically a raw data dump of files of documents out of my files with some notes from me as to what they mean, just showing where a lot of this information comes from. And then I'm also finishing up my fourth book, which I hope will be out soon as well.
Okay, very good. We'll come back with final phone calls with Richard Sauter on Coast to Coast AM, and then Robert Hastings joins us with new information about Roswell, New Mexico. Well, next hour, Robert Hastings joins us as we talk about the Roswell incident, UFOs and nukes as well. Should be fascinating. When we come back, let's take final phone calls with Dr. Richard Sauter on Coast to Coast AM. Richard, what's under Washington, D.C.? I would assume lots of things.
Yes. There's a maze. I've actually spoken to a person who's been under the White House, and it goes very deep. She remembers going down 17 levels and just seeing when she got out of the elevator deep underground, seeing a corridor receding away into the distance to the vanishing point with other doorways and corridors opening off of it. And there are other tunnels. There's a little booklet that was written some years ago called Hogs in the Tunnel by John Alvin, who's an investigative reporter there in Washington, D.C. And he talks about the many different tunnels that he learned about in the time that he was covering news in that area. And I also have plans for building a very deeply buried facility during the Kennedy administration and lapping over into the Johnson administration. The plans for that extended 3,500 feet deep. And I've heard many other stories about tunnels in Washington, D.C. I'm satisfied the place is just tunneled out. It's an anthill.
All right, let's go back to the calls. Hamilton, Montana. Barbara, go ahead. Hi, Barb.
Hi, Al. Hi there. I wanted to call to verify, you know, when you're listening to this stuff, it sounds really hoaxy and paranoid. But 26 years ago, I dated a man who told me that he was construction. And he said that the highest that he had ever been in construction once was a mile high. He said, but it was underground in Virginia. And he said it took over a half hour for the cage, like a mining cage, he said, to get to that point.
Mm-hmm.
So we're talking mile and a half, 2 miles underground in Virginia, where he did a lot of construction.
Where in Virginia, do you remember?
No, I don't.
Yeah.
That's
well,
26 years ago.
Yeah, but, sure.
Yeah, he was just talking about how high he had been in construction.
You mean deep, how deep?
Well, deep, yeah, but yeah. He said the high, and he said he had to go all the way down and, you know, come back up a mile. So he was a mile high off of the ground floor. And
so he would go down and then come back up.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, well, maybe what he did was in order to, if it was an underground mountain base, he may have gone down a shaft to a lower level. Say he went down hundreds of feet or 1,000 feet underground, mm-hmm. and then may have come up inside of a mountain. That may be what he was talking about.
Yeah, but it's to verify that what you're saying is true.
And well, technologically, yes, that's possible.
Yeah.
That's well within the state of the art.
Yeah.
It's not magic, and I believe him. It's consistent with what I have seen in the technical literature. I do not have any specific knowledge of what facility that may have been, but yes, that can be done easily.
Yeah, I wish I was still in contact with him. I would call him and find out where it was at.
Well, that would be interesting to know, but yes, technically it is possible to do that.
Yeah, so we're talking maybe 35 years ago that this happened.
Yeah,
and
well,
so that's a long time ago for be digging like that.
It's been going on for a long time.
Yeah.
And think of all of the money, the trillions of dollars that have been sucked out of our economy. At the same time, we're told there's no money for parks, there's no money for schools, public libraries are decreasing their hours. You see the decline all over this country. Roads can't be repaired. The railroads are falling apart. Bridges in some cases are even falling down, and we see that on the news, and we're told, well, there's just not enough money to take care of all of this. And at the same time, trillions of dollars are being sucked out of the economy for these black projects, which we're not told about. We don't know anything about. We don't know what their purpose is. We don't know who or what is in there. We don't know exactly how many of them there are or exactly where they all are. It's our business.
You know, we haven't talked too much about what the other countries are doing, but are they keeping in the step with us?
I think we're way ahead, George. I think we're the leader of the pack. I think a lot of the darkness is centered right here in the United States, sad to say.
All right. Next up, we go to Libby, Montana. Robert, thank you for calling. You're up with us.
Yeah. Hey, guys. How's it going?
Good, Rob.
Hey, I started listening about 8 or 9 years ago to Coast to Coast AM, and Art Bell had a show on, and it was Mel's Hole. I don't know if
yes.
you guys recollect that, but I
sure
figured it might be a tie-in, and I know there was a big snafu about, you know, the government takeover and that sort of thing, so I wonder if you guys might comment on that. So thanks.
All right.
I have no knowledge at all of Mel's Hole. However, I used to listen to Art Bell quite a lot, and I heard him talking about Mel's Hole quite a lot, but I personally know nothing about Mel's Hole.
And he apparently sold it, and he's moved away. We were working on trying to get him back on the program, Richard, and now his email's not working, so we don't know where the heck this guy is. It was apparently a hole that just seemed to go down to China.
You know, we live on a strange planet, man. I don't know. It's maybe it was a shaft that broke through to some ancient underground facility. I couldn't even begin to say. I never saw it, but I sure heard the story.
Next up, we go to Louisville, Kentucky. It's Aaron's turn. Aaron, go ahead.
Hello, Mr. George.
Hi.
I have a question for the guest. I would like to know if they're doing all this digging, where is the dirt? You know, it ought to be in huge hills everywhere. And do you know anything about the mega caverns, as they're calling it now, where they give you tours here in Louisville, an underground facility that was used for storage and things of that nature?
No, I don't know anything about the Louisville storage facility. There is a similar facility in the Kansas City area where they have a thick limestone layer, and there's actually an underground facility called Subtropolis that was run by the Hunt family, I think, and developed by them, and it's still in use. It's still in active use. It's an industrial and warehousing facility that just extends for miles underground beneath the Kansas City area. So that's one example of that type of facility. As to where they store the dirt, first of all, when you're doing deep underground excavation, most of what you excavate is not dirt but solid rock. And there are a number of ways to get rid of it. You can grind it up and sell it as gravel. And that's one way to make a profit off of it and help to subsidize the project and also move it off the site. If it's an underwater facility, you can simply discharge the tailings that your tunnel boring machines and other excavation create underwater and get rid of them without even bringing them up and dragging them around. It's a waste of time and effort, money and machinery and everything else. So you would just evacuated to the bottom of whatever body of water you were excavating beneath. If you were excavating in a volcanic area, say you're in an extinct volcanic tube system, for example, you could just store whatever you excavate, the tailings you excavate, in an empty magma chamber, for example. So there are a variety of ways of getting rid of these things.
Have you heard about the underwater bases in Puerto Rico?
Yes. I'm glad you raised that issue, George. Jorge Martin has done a lot of research on this question, and it does appear that there are underwater facilities down there. I actually understand that the U.S. Navy has been observed placing some very large cylindrical objects that could possibly be the lock tubes or airlock tubes for entrances to underground bases, the type that would be cemented in the seabed so that you could have ingress and egress for personnel and material from an underwater facility. And also, there's been a lot of discussion of potential extraterrestrial undersea facilities in that region of the Caribbean, and I'm open to more evidence for that.
Let's go to Hawaii. Hello, Dan, first time caller. Thanks for holding, Dan.
Yeah, aloha. I've got a couple questions if I have a moment. One is about Phil Schneider. Fascinating case. The guy says he actually worked on doing excavations, and he sounded like a really high technician. I hope you're familiar with this case, because I'm hoping that you can comment at length on this.
We sure are. And, of course, as you know, Phil is no longer with us. Did you know him at all?
You know, I never met him face-to-face. Phil and I spoke on the telephone a couple of times, and he assured me that he would send me documentation proving that what he said was true. I personally cannot vouch for George's personal claims. Not George's, Phil's personal claims. But in general, it's true they're underground bases. And there's a lot of black budget money and technology involved in making them. There's no question of that. Whether Phil personally was involved in that, I don't know. He never sent me the documentation that he promised. And then, of course, he turned up dead under very ugly circumstances. It looks like he was murdered by parties unknown.
It sure does.
Yeah.
And I have one more question if I had time.
Of course, Dan.
Hawaii, do you know of any bases in Hawaii?
Sure. At Hickam Air Force Base, there's a well-known underground facility. It's been there for years. I don't know if it's still in active use, but it was right at one time there was a big pineapple field there, and right under the pineapple field there was a major underground installation. So that's one I know of. And I would say in general that I strongly suspect, without being able to prove because I don't have documentation, but based on what I have been told informally off the record, and also what I have discovered through my own research, I strongly suspect that there are clandestine underground bases in the Hawaiian island chain, and that these would use extinct magma volcanic chambers, empty magma chambers, and old lava tubes in part.
Wow, because we here at Hawaiian-TV.com basically believe that there's not only underground bases on the Big Island, but I think the Pohakaloa training area is being expanded to actually include more underground area, and that's the scariest thing. And we also consider it really a total, sacrilege to, it's a sacred place. It's a beautiful place.
Yes, I agree, and I don't have any knowledge of these specific cases that you just mentioned. However, I would reiterate that in general, that volcanic geology in Hawaii can be used and worked with to create underground facilities by using existing empty lava tubes and magma chambers, if you understand what I'm saying.
Oh, yeah.
And I also don't exclude the possibility of underwater submarine tunnels and onshore subterranean submarine bases in the Hawaiian Islands. In other words, the submarines would be brought in through the tunnels deep underwater and then would surface underground on shore. You would never see the submarines. You wouldn't see the bases. You wouldn't see the tunnels. Out of sight, out of mind. And again, I don't have documentation for that, but I would give you, just off the top of my head, an informed greater than 50% odds that that's the case.
Viola, Fairbanks, Alaska, west of the Rockies. It's your turn.
Hello, George. Hi, Richard.
Hi.
Thanks for taking my call.
Of course.
I was wondering, do you know if there's any correlation to these underground bases and the hollow earth theory?
Yeah, I don't know. You know, the hollow earth theory has been around for a long time, and I'll tell you frankly, I don't know what's inside the world. And I have asked people who I thought would know with expertise in geophysics and geology, and the honest ones will give you the same answer that I just did. They will say we have theories about what's down there, but the hard truth is that no one concretely knows exactly what is inside the planet. So I have to say that I don't know if there's anything to this hollow earth theory or not. I'm sure there are many mysteries in the universe, and while I don't know if there's a hollow earth, I can't say that there isn't, on the other hand, either.
Right. Theoretically, would you say that these lava tubes and these underground caverns couldn't effectively reach the other side if there were, where they could link up?
You know, my knowledge base is, and I'm supposedly a moderately well-educated Western man, but I'm telling you that I don't know. And I no longer, because of my research, necessarily presume that things I used to know earlier in my life, or that I assumed that I know, are in reality true. I'm at an interesting place where I've come to understand how thick the lies are that we are besieged by on every hand. And the lies start early in childhood. We're lied to about all kinds of things from A to Z. And I'm willing to see more evidence about what really is inside the earth. I've read different theories and different accounts. I personally don't know. And I think that's the only intellectually honest position that I can take.
These talks that George Norrie gives remind me that humans used to think the earth was flat. So I know there's a lot that we don't know.
Well, there's tons that we don't know, and that's part of the reason we're on the earth, to learn.
Okay. Well, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Okay, we'll go to Eugene, Oregon now. Hello, Mike. You're up.
Hi, George. Richard, I think about the big picture a lot, and I think all of these underground bases are sort of this is the base of operation for what I see is the takeover of humanity. You know, 95% of people would scoff at this material. And it goes way beyond this, in my opinion.
Yeah,
so,
yeah, you know, I agree. And I would say that while this activity seems to be intensely concentrated in North America, you do find underground undersea bases in other regions of the world, but it really centers most intensively on the United States. It's really concentrated here. And go ahead with the rest of your comment.
Thank you. My question is humanity going to wake up, or are we doomed to be in an obvious prison planet situation?
Well, I think you find both at the same time. There are people who are waking up. Think back to 50 years ago, if you're that old, and how things were in the 1950s and how totally propagandized people were by the millions. I think you have a large number of people now who are waking up that you didn't have in past decades and centuries. So that has changed. But on the other hand, as you observe, there's still many, many people, perhaps still the majority, who are fast asleep. So you find the both at the same time. And it's just a real tough nut to crack. I don't know what's going to happen. I'm not going to say that we're doomed, but it may be that a certain percentage are.
The name of Richard Sauter's new book and his latest work, Underground Bases and Tunnels, and he's working on more. Superb investigation, Richard, Underground Bases. In a moment, Robert Hastings joins us. Later on, calls with him, UFOs and Nukes, Extraordinary Encounters at Nuclear Weapons Sites. Well, fascinating with Mr. Sauter. And now up next, Robert Hastings. We will be talking about a former U.S. Atomic Energy Commissioner and supervisor about revelations about Roswell and that incident. That'll be next on Coast to Coast AM. Robert Hastings, UFO researcher, lecturer. He has researched declassified U.S. government documents confirming UFO incursions at nuclear weapons sites occurring as early as 1948. Robert has interviewed nearly 100 U.S. Air Force veterans who were involved in nuclear weapons-related UFO incidents as well. And here he is on Coast to Coast. Robert, good morning. How are you?
Thank you for having me. Almost awake.
We'll get you. 1 hour. It's quick.
Okay.
You've done some work with into Chet Lightholz, the former U.S. Atomic Energy Commissioner. Tell me about this.
Well, in 1990, I was introduced to Chet Lytle by Kevin Randall and Don Schmidt, who, of course, are two of the best well-known Roswell researchers. Uh-huh. And in the course of a group dinner in Albuquerque, Mr. Lytle, who during World War II worked on the Manhattan Project, the atomic bomb project, and later did a number of classified things for various departments and agencies within the U.S. government, including the Atomic Energy Commission, leaned over to me and just more or less said, I'm aware of certain nuclear weapons-related UFO incidents. He had obviously been tipped off that that was my specialty. Presumably Kevin Randall or Don Schmidt told him about that. In any case, I took the opportunity to ask him to elaborate and ask him if he would be willing to be formally interviewed on the record. And he suddenly backtracked and said, no, I still have contracts with the government here in Albuquerque, my company, and I just don't want to rock the boat. So that's where the matter lay for 5 or 6 years and or longer. And finally, in September of 1998, I talked him into finally sitting down with me, and we did a two-hour taped interview, and during which he said some very amazing things.
Did he tell you much about his background?
That was already a matter of record. I knew on this two-hour tape I have references to him having done work for the Central Intelligence Agency during the Cuban Missile Crisis. His company manufactured some underwater munition lockers that were used to store weapons for the anti-Castro Cubans, very sensitive stuff. He also worked on radar development in the 1950s. He also worked on autopilot design, and he told me that he possessed copyrights or patents, I guess the term would be, for an atomic or a nuclear reactor system that was to be fitted on one of our strategic bombers back in the 50s. That project was abandoned for various reasons, but he had his fingers in just about everything. The Manhattan Project, in particular, the creation of the first atomic bomb, his company, Lytle Engineering, created what were called lenses, high explosive charges that were symmetrically placed around the plutonium core of the bomb that was exploded down in Alamogordo, a tower-mounted device. And these lenses were electronically detonated simultaneously to cause the two halves of the plutonium core to fuse together to create the critical mass, which in turn created the first atomic explosion in the world. So he was involved with some, you know, revolutionary types of projects for the U.S. government over time.
All right, some of the things that he was revealing to you on tape, did they startle you at all, Robert?
Well, I have to say yes. And before we get into the Roswell material, he told me, for example, that he and a gentleman named General Kenner Hertford, who was the deputy director of the Armed Forces Special Weapons Project here at Kirtland Air Force Base, Sandia Labs, in the early 50s, Lytle and General Hertford were out on the runway at Kirtland Air Force Base one night watching a bomb being loaded, an atomic bomb being loaded onto a bomber, which was then flown to the Nevada test site for a test detonation. And he said as they were watching this operation, they both noticed these three bright lights in the sky south of the base near the Manzano Mountains. General Hertford ran into a building and got, he was looking for binoculars, but ended up with what's called a theodolite. It's a technical telescope. And both he and Lytle looked through the telescope and saw what Chet Lytle called a saucer-shaped object, a disc-shaped object with a central dome structure. And there were three of those apparently identical side by side. And, you know, this was, the general said, this is top secret, don't discuss it with anyone. So that was one of the incidents. Lytle also told me that up at the Nevada test site during the frequent nuclear tests during the 1950s, the atmospheric tests that were being conducted up there, that a number of the photographic aircraft pilots employed by EG&G Corporation, who were contracted to all the films anyone has ever seen of atomic bombs going off in the deserts of Nevada, they were taken by EG&G Corporation. Lytle told me that a number of pilots had repeatedly sighted UFOs in the test areas just prior to the detonations. I have independent confirmation of that from other military people, ex-military people. But so he had some pretty dramatic things to say, yes, involving UFO activity. He also happened to mention that while he was doing advanced radar experiment or engineering down at White Sands in southern New Mexico, that UFOs would come in and traveling like Mach 3, 4, and 5. That's Mach 5 would be roughly 3,500 miles per hour. Lytle said that these things would fly in out of nowhere at these unbelievable speeds and then instantaneously stop and hover and just freak everybody out on the ground when tracking these things. They were flying, you know, several times faster than any known aircraft on Earth at the time. So Lytle was involved in some extremely dramatic incidents or aware of them secondhand by virtue of his position with the Atomic Energy Commission and other classified projects.
Robert, any reason to doubt him?
None whatsoever. And Kevin Randall can tell you this, or Don Schmidt, if you choose to have them on. His record speaks for itself. I walked into his office where I interviewed him. I've never seen so many plaques on any one given office wall from various agencies and departments of the U.S. government that were, lauding his company's engineering efforts for one project or another. His track record was impeccable. I have to add on a personal level that, you know, after he sort of hinted that he had some dramatic information, he at the same time decided or thought better of it, and it took me several years before he decided to go on the record. So this was not somebody who was gushing information with abandon. He was very careful about what he said, and in a few minutes, I'll tell you how this all came out. There were consequences for his ultimately being candid with me.
And he's no longer with us, right?
He passed in 2004. And I've since tried to follow up with his son. In my book, UFOs and Nukes, I have quite a bit of information about Chet Lytle. And I wanted his son to confirm it and to verify it. And he reviewed it, but he backed off because of certain events that took place after Lytle spoke with me.
What did Lytle learn about Roswell, and how did he learn about it?
Well, this came at me out of the blue. It was toward the end of the interview, and we were talking about the types of incidents, the incidents that I mentioned a moment ago. And he basically, out of the blue, said, I heard directly from William Blanchard that the Roswell object was, in fact, a recovered alien spaceship. And that got my attention. And I asked for the details. And he said that in February of 1953, he was at that time a supervisor with the Atomic Energy Commission involved in weapons stockpiling. He was involved in the supervision of the transfer of weapons from weapons storage areas to our frontline bases. where they were being loaded on atomic bombers and being prepared for potential war with the Soviets. In any case, in February of 1953, he was in Alaska at Eielson Air Force Base. At the time, William Blanchard, who was the former base commander of Roswell Army Airfield during the Roswell incident, he, by that time, had been promoted to Brigadier General in the U.S. Air Force. His job with Strategic Air Command, 8th Air Force, was to supervise the training of bomber crews, B-36, our strategic bomber, bomber crews up at Eielson Air Force Base in Alaska. So their paths crossed up there. Lytle told me that at the same time, his wife was giving birth to his son, Chet Lytle Jr., in Chicago, and he was frantic to get back to Chicago. He said that General Blanchard offered to fly him there personally on a bomber to Chanute Air Force Base, or an Air Force Base near Chicago. Chet couldn't remember the name, whereupon Lytle would take a commercial flight up to Chicago. In any case, on this long flight back from Alaska to Illinois, the subject of UFOs came up. There had been a number of UFO sightings near Elmendorf Air Force Base in Alaska, sightings by our bomber crews up there. In the course of discussing those sightings, according to Lytle, General Blanchard suddenly admitted that while he was the base commander at Roswell Army Airfield, he was involved in the recovery of a crashed alien spaceship. And it's doubtful that Lytle may have even heard about it back in 1953, given that after the flurry of activity in July of 47, the Army Air Force quickly changed its story and said this was a weather balloon and so on. We all know that story. So by the time, 6 years later, it's doubtful that the average American, including Lytle, was aware of the facts surrounding the Roswell case in general. So he was quite startled to hear General Blanchard admit all of this. In any case, according to Lytle, Blanchard said that four alien bodies, humanoid bodies, had been recovered, and that this, in fact, had taken place. Now, at that time, Chet Lytle, in his capacity as weapons stockpiling supervisor for the Atomic Energy Commission, his office was at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base.
Uh-huh.
And so he was at the right place at the right time to learn additional information. He told me that he wouldn't name these individuals other than Blanchard. He referenced four or five other persons who gave him tidbits of information, but he refused to identify any of those persons, despite my repeated efforts to get the names. But he said that he was told by another high-level reliable source that the bodies were, some of the bodies, quote-unquote, were initially sent to Muroc Air Force Base, California. That's now Edwards Air Force Base.
Mm-hmm.
But that they all eventually wound up, quote-unquote, wound up at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base. Actually, it was Wright Field at the time in 47. In any case, Lytle told me also that his military aide, his Air Force aide, that more or less assisted him in his duties, his military liaison duties at Wright-Patt, this individual's wife was the secretary for the general at Wright-Patt, whose job was to guard the bodies. And so he was periodically getting tidbits from people associated with what was going on over there. He said that he was privy to leaks from persons who had seen the autopsies, knew that autopsies on the bodies were taking place. He further said that the craft itself, the crash craft, was located in, he said, Hangar 5. We've all heard about Hangar 18 in Roswell. Lytle claimed that it was Hangar 5 that had the actual debris from the spacecraft, and further said that he was heavily cleared. He told me, quote, this is almost word for word, I was heavily cleared to do the work I did with weapons stockpiling, but I was never allowed into that area. So what I emphasize in my book in discussing all of this, and I will right now also, is that there are no declassified documents to corroborate any of this. There are no independent eyewitnesses to substantiate the conversation he had with Blanchard. But given Lytle's track record, his professional background, and so forth, I consider him a highly credible source. Now, this conversation took place in September of 1998, and 3 years later, I had some information came my way that I wanted to follow up on and pursue with him. So I called him up in November of 2001 and asked him if I could get some additional details on this story about Roswell, and he was extremely reluctant. His whole manner was very curt, and he reluctantly agreed to sit down with me again a second time. When I showed up at his office, I attempted to clip the microphone onto his lapel again, and he said, "We're not going to tape this." And I was puzzled, and I said, you know, reminded him that he had talked to me for nearly 2 hours, 3 years previously. And he let out this big breath, this deep sigh, and drummed his fingers on his desktop and looked me in the eye and said, "After you and I talked, I was paid a visit. And someone wanted to know why I was talking to you and Don Schmidt." And, you know, I said, you know, who will you tell me who this person was? He would not. I said, "Will you tell me at least the agency or department of the government that they were affiliated with?" He would not. And so he was basically deflecting all of my questions about what had taken place. And he finally said, I've spent decades building my business here, and I just don't want to take any chances." And so apparently someone leaned on him.
They got to him.
And so that's where the matter lay. And I moved out of state for 3 years, and it wasn't until 2006, that I contacted his company and found out that he had passed away 2 years previously. And I had a very cordial conversation with his son about this conversation I had had with his late father. And I said, "I want to send you this summary of my interview with him, and I'd like you to review it." And he was quite cordial, quite friendly. However, the next time I called, he refused to take my calls and has subsequently refused to take my calls.
Really? Was he aware prior to you talking to him about it, about what his father experienced?
If he was, he did not drop any hint of that in the conversation that we had. So I don't know the answer to that, to be honest.
Robert, have you ever been threatened?
Well, as I've explained in the past, I think we discussed this when I was on the program back in February. I went out on the college lecture circuit with my program on UFO activity at nuclear weapons sites in September of 81. And by December of 81, I was getting some international publicity in the media. And by February, I started having strange problems with my telephone. And around that same time, I linked up with a now-deceased researcher named Todd Zeckel. Todd Zeckel, some of your listeners will know the name. He was involved in a lawsuit against the Central Intelligence Agency back in the 70s to get some of their documents on UFOs declassified. In any case, Todd and I hooked up around January or February of 82. And in the course of a number of our conversations where we were trading notes and, you know, sharing information, suddenly we would get this strange high-pitched sound, extremely loud, and then the phone would go dead. And this happened repeatedly, variations on that. It never happened at any other time when I was talking to anyone, friends, family, strangers, just Todd and I. And similar problems began occurring when I would contact military sources and interview them over the phone within sometimes 5 minutes, sometimes an hour, sometimes 24 hours after those conversations. I would get a call where somebody would be on the other end not speaking for about 30 seconds, and they'd hang the phone up. And that has basically been a fixture, variations on that, since the early 1980s. So that is the kind of harassment that I've experienced. I did have someone call.
Let's talk a little bit more about that, Robert, when we come back. And these apparent UFO visitations at nuke sites, next on Coast to Coast AM. Robert, you're talking about these possible visitations or threats. You had a couple more points, and then let's talk about the nuke sites. Go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say that in 1985, I got a tip from a former Air Force security guard who, it turns out, worked out at Area 51. He didn't mention the name of the facility, but he just happened to say, you ought to check into this facility out in the desert, which I had never heard about. And a couple weeks later, I was speaking at University of Nevada, Las Vegas, and I happened, during the question and answer session, mentioned cryptically this information that was related to me, and I knew there were people from Nellis Air Force Base in the audience. So I said, I'm curious about this rumor. I don't want anybody to violate a security oath, but if anyone wants to talk to me about that, I'm all ears. Well, no one came up and talked to me except my student sponsor, who said, my dad works at Nellis. He's here tonight, and he wanted me to tell you that the base commander was in the back row.
I love it.
So, coincidentally or not, the next day, for about 8 hours, a heavy-set man driving a white Chevy followed me all around Las Vegas quite openly, and presumably on orders. He quite clearly was ordered to let me know that I was, that he was there, and I think they thought I was going to try to meet with someone to get information about Area 51. I don't know, but that actually happened. But other than that, and a lesser dramatic, not as dramatic incident, the first year I went out on the lecture circuit, the only problems I really had are telephone and email issues.
Tell me why these UFOs that have been seen, spotted all over this planet near nuke sites, why are they showing up there?
Well, first of all, it is going on. There are declassified documents going back to January of 1949, at least that early, talking about UFO activity up at the Los Alamos lab in New Mexico, where the atomic bomb was invented. Other documents indicate that UFOs have been at every principal nuclear laboratory in the 40s and 50s, in the 50s, I should say, Oak Ridge, Hanford site, Savannah River. I mean, it's across the board. And I now know from witnesses that this type of activity occurred at the atomic test site up in Nevada, the Nevada test site. And then later in the 60s, when nuclear missiles came into play, these incidents were going on at ICBM sites, nuclear missile sites, where objects, disc-shaped objects, would come in and hover over either launch control facilities or the missile silos themselves. And as we've discussed, and probably many of your listeners know, there are now a number of retired Air Force personnel, launch officers, whom I've interviewed at various bases, who said that their missiles actually malfunctioned precisely at a time when these UFOs were hovering over their nukes. I have a 600-page book, UFOs and Nukes, devoted to that information, interview after interview after interview with these people, three of whom appeared with me on Larry King about a year ago. Now, that's all factual. The question is why. I am of the opinion that whoever are flying these craft are interested in sending a signal to both Washington and Moscow, the nuclear powers in general, that having nuclear weapons is not healthy for the human race or the planet. And I think what is going on is a covert, in the sense that the public in general is unaware of these things, by and large, but the military, the people in the Pentagon, the CIA, the Kremlin know it's going on, and it's been going on decade after decade after decade. And in my view, and this opinion is shared by three-quarters of my over 100 now, 120 ex-military sources whom I've interviewed, we believe that someone is, in effect, wagging a finger at humankind, at the nuclear powers, saying, get rid of your nukes. Now, that is purely speculative on my part, but I believe that's a viable scenario given the available facts.
Why would they care about whether we blow ourselves up, Robert? I always assumed maybe these atomic explosions do something to the universe, basically. They do something that affects them.
I think that's entirely within the realm of possibility. Again, it's anyone who says they know the answer is blowing smoke.
Sure.
I doubt that the people in the Pentagon and the CIA are even, confident that they know the answer. But let's look at the number of scenarios. You've got, first of all, they're protecting themselves in some way. physics has gotten so complicated in recent years. What used to be fairly straightforward about how the universe was organized and how it worked has kind of been turned on its head. And if anyone's familiar with string theory and parallel universes and all sorts of current ideas that the theoretical physicists are now putting out, it's quite possible that these beings are much closer to our part of the universe than one would suspect by virtue of parallel dimensions and all sorts of things like that. I'm not going to attempt to technically explain them. So your point, in short, is certainly well within the realm of possibility. I prefer to think in terms of whoever these guys are, whoever these beings are, they have a moral sense. They're looking at a savage planet that has the potential of destroying itself, the species, humans that run the show here. And they're, in effect, trying to guide us through our teenage years, our adolescence, so we can emerge on the other side intact and take our place in the community of intelligent races within our galaxy. That's one possibility. But I also point out to my lecture audiences is it's in, you know, within the realm of possibility that whoever they are planning to invade Earth, and they don't want to inherit a radioactive wasteland.
That's, you know, a good possibility.
I mean, no one knows. And, you know, like I said, there's lots of potential explanations. But the activity is so well documented. You know, the number of sources that are now coming forward and talking about this. I am hoping within a year's time to organize, I'm not going to go into details, but a press conference at the National Press Club, at which time there will be somewhere in the neighborhood of 20 former or retired Air Force personnel.
Perfect.
Who will divulge all of this to the international media. And hopefully this will get the ball rolling in terms of some sort of disclosure process. That's the fond hope, anyway.
All right, let's go to some of the calls. We'll go to Tucson, Arizona. Johnny, you're up with us on Coast to Coast.
It's a pleasure to join you. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
It's okay, here's the deal. I lived in SoCal. I lived in the greater Los Angeles area for a long, long time. And I lived next door to a gentleman who worked for the government. And about three times a year, there'd be these crisp, uniformed people that would come to my door and ask me questions about this man. You know, does he party? Is there police action? Is there stuff going on there? Blah, blah, blah. After a while, I got a little curious, and I started asking him questions. And I said, I'd always tell the military, yeah, he's the greatest guy in the world. You know, he's totally straight as an arrow. But after a while, I started asking him questions. We'd sit around in the summer and listen to the Beach Boys and have a beer in the backyard and stuff. And I started asking him questions about Area 51. I'd say, listen, if you can't answer the question, just smile and wink. But if you can answer, you know, answer. And so he'd say, okay, cool. So I said, is there Area 51? He said, yes. I said, have you been there? He goes, yes. I go, how'd you get there? He goes, in a van with no windows and no way to see where you're going, and it's secret, and they just take you in there, and you get in there. I said, well, that's really interesting. Okay, cool. And he said, but you know what? You know what's more interesting than Area 51 is Area 58. And I don't know if you guys have ever heard of this, but this is like the new generation of UFO stuff, is Area 58. So I don't know if he was just blowing smoke. I don't think he was, because he was a real straight shooter. But, you know, this was a really, really interesting aspect of this whole dimension.
All right, very good. Fascinating. Has the Chernobyl episode and a UFO that was reported over that area been a story that you investigated, Robert?
I didn't investigate that, but in one of the appendices in my book, I do discuss sightings at civilian nuclear power plants. For those listeners not knowing what we're talking about here, the Soviet Ukraine, in April of 1986, one of their reactors exploded, the Chernobyl plant. And what has emerged just within the last 10 years are stories from persons who were involved in monitoring radiation for the Soviet government, who were sent to the site within hours of the explosion to monitor radiation levels. And the stories that have been reported, I think probably in the early 90s, I'd have to look at the book, but within the last 10 years, there have been stories in Pravda and in the Ukrainian media where these radiation monitoring teams have described seeing a brass-colored object, reddish-orange, let's call it, bright, fiery object hovering directly above the Chernobyl plant within hours of the explosion. And they're, what they've told the media over there is that they witnessed beams, two beams of light, crimson in color, emanating, coming down from this round, this spherical UFO directly into the smoking ruins of the reactor. And the bottom line was they had taken radiation readings prior to the appearance of this object, which I believe from memory were something like, from their position, 800 millirentgens per hour. 3,000 millirentgens per hour, and when the object left, the next time they took readings, they had dropped to 800 millirentgens per hour, a dramatic decrease in the radiation level in the ambient area, the immediate area, for which they had no scientific explanation. And the person giving the interviews said that there were hundreds of witnesses to the appearance of this object. That's quite a dramatic story, and apparently the sources are legitimate and are bona fide. They're not, you know, crazies making up this story.
Robert, you've done a great job, by the way, investigating this.
Thank you.
Like no one else. UFOs and Nukes, that's his work. North Carolina we go. Kinsey, you're up with us. Hi, Kinsey.
Hi there. Good morning, gentlemen. I was actually calling. I've been listening just a couple months now, and I just everything seems connected. I mean, you know, it seems to me like you said earlier that we were seeded. It seems like we were put here, and it's kind of like they're guiding us. They're doing experiments genetically, getting different mutations, different diseases, cures. I mean, it just seems like everything's kind of interconnected.
It sure does, doesn't it, Robert?
I've had a lifelong interest in UFOs. When I was a teenager in the 1960s, there were sightings almost every day that were in the media and so on. As I mentioned in my book, what really kick-started all of this for me was my dad was career Air Force, and he was stationed at Malmstrom Air Force Base in 1966 and 67. At the time, some of the incidents involving UFOs shutting down nuclear missiles were taking place. So that's what really sparked my interest in all of this. So while I can speak authoritatively to the nuclear weapons-related cases, beyond that, I think I'm really no more I have no more insight than most people in terms of what's going on. I am of the opinion that what we now call UFOs probably have been around for thousands of years. Whether they seeded us here or not, or have just been monitoring human development, I don't presume to know. It's pretty fascinating. But I don't think that what has gone on since World War II is certainly out of the blue. I think it's been around for a long, long time. It just so happens that if you look at the general level of UFO activity in the 100 years or so that preceded World War II and the creation of nuclear weapons, the level of activity was fairly modest. And there were periodic reports in the media around the world of what we would now call UFO sightings. But all of that just spiked. It just went exponential right at the time we developed and began to test and deploy and threaten to use in warfare nuclear weapons. And I'm quite convinced that there's a connection.
Okay, let's go to Eddie in Nashville, Tennessee. Go ahead, Eddie.
Yes, Robert, I worked at the Nevada test site for the Lawrence Radiation Laboratory in the early 60s. I had a high Q clearance, which is the highest you can get. And your one thing you're wrong about, we did all of our own films. We did all of our high-speed films and all our still photography and all that. EG&G was a support group for us. LRL did 80% of the testing. Los Alamos did 20% of the testing out there. And we knew about Roswell in the early 60s. Otto Krauss, a project physicist out there, was in Roswell or in Alamogordo when all that happened. And he's a person that we worked with, and he was telling us about Roswell one night playing hearts. And that wasn't the real issue. The real issue was I grew up in Farmington, New Mexico, and the crash that we got at Aztec was the one that was taking the Hangar 18. It had a pinhole in the porthole, and there were three charred bodies inside, about 4 foot high in stature. And that's the one that took them 3 weeks to get into the craft to figure out how to get into it. And, you know, I was in Hart Canyon 2 days after they took that craft out of there, and I can tell you there were truck tracks everywhere out there, and normally you'd see a Jeep track out there once in a while. But a friend of mine and I rode our horses out there because there was an article in the paper about it, and then the article disappeared. They come out and said it was a hoax the next day, and everybody in Farmington could remember the article about the hoax. Nobody remembers the article about the crash in at Hart Canyon.
Okay, well, I can't address that. I don't know about that. I do know for a fact, not only from Chattel Idol, but that EG&G was indeed contracted to do films in the late 40s and early 50s. You said you were at the Nevada test site, I believe, in the 1960s.
Yeah.
So jurisdiction may, in fact, have changed. I wouldn't presume to know that, but I do know from sources independent of Idol that EG&G was given a film contract. Not only for Nevada, but the Pacific test sites down at Eniwetok and Kauai.
They did most of the photography over in Area 51.
Okay,
but as far as in the test site itself, we did all of our own. We were over in Area 51 at times, and the guy that called in earlier.
Sir, my
right.
point, you were there in the 1960s, correct?
And when you went to Area 51,
my point is you were there beginning in the 1960s, correct?
Yeah.
Okay, what I'm saying is
20 seconds left, Robert.
Okay. A decade earlier, there were EG&G contracted pilots in the Nevada test site area and in the South Pacific test areas.
Very good. Robert, once again, thank you so much for the work you've been doing.
Thank you. Community
needs that, my friend.
I appreciate
Robert
you having me on.
UFOs and nukes, extraordinary encounters at nuclear weapons sites. Don't forget our program tomorrow, of course, will be with Daryl Sims, none other than the alien hunter. For Dan Galante, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean Latasseur, Ross Mitchell, George Nappy, and Punnett and Art Bell, I'm George Norrie, somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM. We'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everyone.